The mission of our faith is to teach the fragile art of hospitality, to welcome all who need a safe place to grow into their wisdom, to revere the critical mind and the generous heart, to prove that diversity does not always lead to divisiveness, to honor this life with its passages of joy and woe, to support the many paths to truth, so that we may have the courage to hold the whole world in our open and loving arms. Welcome, everybody, to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. It's a pleasure to have all of you with us this morning, and I welcome you to enter into this space with all your questions, with everything that you need, and to find a place of peace. As Unitarian Universalists, we envision a day when all that is divided will merge. Compassion will be the driving force of power, and tenderness will come into a world that is harsh and often unkind, and that all men and women, regardless of race, economics, sexual orientation, will celebrate with one another the Earth's abundance, and we will treat the Earth with respect and share our awe of the cosmos, and find that we shall find our way to live in harmony with all life seen and unseen.
Good morning. My name's Linda Kreger, and I joined the fellowship about 2 months ago. I was a practicing Catholic, and then my younger son told me that he was gay, and I couldn't go to the Catholic Church and feel good anymore. So my friend Willis Matta told me about the fellowship, and it's just been a good place for me. So today, I am going to read a quote from Cheryl Wright. She's a country western star that grew up in Wellsville, Kansas, and it's a prayer she used to say. She's 39 and she came out, and she's not been asked back to Nashville since then. And when I read her book and read the prayer, it's a very similar prayer to what my son told me he used to say. And I think if my son had been here at the fellowship, his prayer probably would have been completely different. So this is how she used to pray. Dear God, please don't let me be gay. I promise to be a good person. I promise not to lie. I promise not to steal. I promise to always believe in you. I promise to do all the things you ask me to do. Please take it away. In your name, I pray this. Amen. I'm a proud Kansan, a loving daughter, sister, friend, a child of God, and a lesbian. I used to know the difference between right and wrong, and telling my story is the right thing to do.
I draw your attention to our order of service and the announcements within. And Shirley has asked me to remind everyone that coffee will be served in the Inez Alsop room after the service. So please join us for conversation and fellowship. Now let us sing O Come, O Come Emmanuel, hymn number 225.
Give comfort to all.
Very beautiful. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. So if you have a personal joy and or sorrow, this would be the time to share it.
All right, sorry, I just want to check something. Jim Chanteau. Well, I think it's a joy in one sense. Winter has come. The choir this morning was singing songs about winter, so we were all fully reminded of the change in seasons. And I mean, some people kind of regret it. I grew up in California, and we didn't have seasons. And so it's always been a marvel to be here in Kansas and to see the change in seasons and to know that following winter there will be spring and we will have summer. And you know, it's just a marvelous thing to see the changes in the world around us, and I hope the changes within ourselves to match what the topic is this morning. One quick note, by the way, this afternoon, 3 o'clock, the Flint Hills Masterworks Chorale will be performing at the First Methodist Church on Points, and you're all invited. It's a free concert. I'll be singing Christmas music preceded by Magnificat. Magnificat by John Rutter. It's a truly marvelous piece.
Anna Franklin, hi. I have a joy. I have a lot of joys this morning, and it's really all of you. I'm just feeling really happy to have so many wonderful friends here. And my other joy is the privilege of being able to bring Iris Kingery Page to church to sing for choir practice in the mornings and get to sit next to her. And it's wonderful to have another soprano in the choir. So,
Shirley Hobrock, welcoming chair. We have another joy this morning. Mary Peterson has decided to become a member. Mary, would you stand up? Okay. Mary, would you join us later when we have get up for the recognition?
Glenn Wary, I have three joys this morning. Yesterday's class, my Reiki seminar for energy healing, was a smashing success. I have 9 new Reiki practitioners under me, dying for level 2. The second is we have a Reiki share at Bellis on Wednesday at 6 in their back classroom. So people that are interested in Reiki energy healing, come talk to me and we'll talk. And then the third is that my son Tyler has his orchestra concert at the mall on Monday at noon for anybody who's out and wanting to support him.
My name is Tara McGreer-White, and I have a sorrow and just a brief story to share about it. Since I was here last, my grandmother, who was 88, passed away, and she had 22 grandchildren and 33 great-grandchildren and lived at home up until the very end and died very suddenly of a heart attack while having tea with her dear friend and her husband, who was 92. And so everyone, all of those people, went home for the funeral back up to Nebraska. And on my way home, it's kind of hard to find a direct route from north down. And so I turned on my GPS. And I was disgusted then because it took me through this sort of winding back roads, you know. And I got stuck behind a very slow car. And but I didn't want to pass. And we went past this tiny little town of Gilead, Nebraska, which is about 30 people, and there's a sign on the road that says there is a balm in Gilead, and then I thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to be on this road today, and then when I finally get into a bigger town and was able to pass this car, I see that the license plate says G. Ma Pat. And that was the name of my grandmother, Grandma Pat. And I don't know what to do with this, except that in a time of a sorrow, it brought me a little bit of joy.
So for all the joys and sorrows and concerns and things that we celebrate in our life, let us be mindful that there are others who have similar joys and concerns in their hearts and minds that they have not shared, and that as a community we are here to support each other no matter where we seem to be and where we really are. So let us be thankful. Marissa.
Awesome. All right, how many of you guys think you can grow up and be and do whatever you want? Raise your hands if you think you can be and do whatever you want when you're... Oh, come on. I'm sure, don't your parents say, you know, you can be and do whatever you want if you work hard for it, right? Awesome. Well, thankfully, in this day and age, most of you can grow up and be and do whatever you want. Nothing's, you know, for the most part, nothing's going to hold you back if it's something that you want and you work hard enough for it. But imagine you were born 100 years ago. Girls would not be allowed to vote, have certain professions, play sports, do things like that. Black people would not be allowed to vote, own property. Black people and white people couldn't get married to each other. If you were a white man and you had property, then you were good to go. But if you were anybody else, you couldn't grow up to be whatever you wanted. And the reason that we now have a lot of those rights is because of democracy, and because of fighting for them. And there are still lots of people today who don't have rights. Gay people can't marry whoever they want in most places in the United States. And women are still fighting for the right to control their medical decisions. So democracy is not a done deal. It's a continuous process. And So I wanted you to think about perseverance. Do you guys know what perseverance is? Iris. That's right. It means never giving up. And so do you think in democracy that you can just say, well, we got this right, and so we're done? Or we don't have this right yet, and it seems like it's going to be a really hard fight, so maybe we'll just give up? No. Do you think we have to have perseverance? Yeah. Jake. Do you also think democracy is something that we just each do individually, or is it something that we have to work together with? Together. I wanted to tell you guys something famous from the Holocaust, a famous saying from the Holocaust. Do you guys know what the Holocaust was? World War II? Do you know what happened in World War II with all the in Germany and Europe with all the Jews being targeted for being killed, all the Jews were being killed? Well, there was a man who said, after World War II was over, he said, you know, first they came for the socialists, and I wasn't a socialist, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for the trade unions, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't speak up. And then they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't speak up. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up for me. So to me, that's what democracy is. Even if it's not your own personal right that you're fighting for, it's best to help each other, and we all fight for each other's rights. And so I was going to end with one little story. A curious man once asked to visit heaven and hell. Expecting hell to be a terrible, frightening place, he was amazed to find people seated around a lovely banquet table. The table was piled high with every delicious thing one could possibly want. The man thought, perhaps hell is not so bad after all. Looking closely, however, he noticed that everyone at the table was miserable. They were starving because, although there was a mountain of food before them, they had been given 3-foot-long chopsticks. There was no way to carry the food to their mouths with such long chopsticks, and so no one could eat a bite. The man was then taken to heaven. To his surprise, he found the exact same situation as he had seen in hell. People were gathered around a banquet table piled with food. All the diners held a pair of 3-foot-long chopsticks in their hands. But there in heaven, everyone was happily eating the delicious food, for the residents of heaven were using their extra-long chopsticks to feed one another. All right, go now in peace. Go now in peace. Bye.
Around you everywhere you
That was just great.
I'm not giving up my day job. All right. Today's Helping Hand recipient are families that are residing at the Manhattan Emergency Shelter. As in the past, we have chosen 2 families to help this Christmas. Unfortunately, both of these families are victims of domestic abuse and have had to utilize the shelter as a safe haven. The first family has 1 child, a 10-year-old girl who likes crafts and fishing, biking, and wearing mismatched socks. The second family has 4 children, ranging from newborn to 8 years old. And their needs and wish lists range from Hot Wheels car track to the basic necessities for newborn care. If we can meet the needs for these children, it would be amazing if we could also purchase some needed items for the mothers of these children. Our RE children have been planning with excitement the shopping trip to purchase these gifts for our adopted families. It would be so wonderful if we could cross everything off of the list that they filled out. I encourage all of you to give as generously as you can while contemplating how very fortunate we all are in our own lives. Imagine how thankful these families will be if we can share the things that we all take for granted with them. So any donations that are placed in the basket that aren't specifically marked to go to UU will go to the Helping Hands Fund for this Sunday. Did you have a question? Actually, I think they appreciate, well, there was a thing that said, all right, perfect.
This morning, it's a great privilege to celebrate those people who have joined the fellowship in the last couple of months. If you're one of those people, please come forward. We welcome Linda Krieger, Jane Pelletier, Fred Reynolds, Sue Prey, Sabrina Bowker, Angela and Glenn Wary, and Mary Peterson. Please come forward if you would. You want to come up on the, so I can see you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Today we welcome into our community these new members who have chosen to make a commitment to this congregation by signing our membership book. New members, we are glad to have you here with us and that you have chosen this community of fellow seekers to grow together and our capacity to live in an evolving truth that reveals the complexity and beauty of what it means to be human. Will you accept our gifts of fellowship, discovery, and service? Will you offer your unique presence and gifts? Will you add your name to the long history of Unitarian and Universalist women and men who spread hope with our living faith? Will you engage with us as we seek to create a community and a world dedicated to love and justice? If so, to all those say, we will, or I will. Wait a minute. I think we have a little bit more enthusiasm. All right. Congregation, will you welcome these members with the warmth and comfort of your fellowship? Will you seek to add your strengths and talents to the new gifts they bring to us? Will you share our triumphs and our struggles as our community grows and changes?
We will.
All right. In the midst of our beautiful diversity of belief, we seek to dwell together in peace, to seek truth and love, and to help one another. We celebrate this great purpose by welcoming each of you into the life of this, our beloved community. Welcome. Most of you know Abraham Lincoln. He was addressing some visitors and he said, "Some Union supporters oppose any accommodation or yielding to the South in any manner because the Confederates began the war and should be held responsible." Now this, he said, reminds me of a good story I heard once when I lived in Illinois. A farmer had a vicious bull that took after anybody who tried to cross the field. One day, a neighbor climbed the fence and was soon running for his life. This man was fast, and he got to a tree with the bull close behind. There was no time to climb the tree, so he led the bull around the tree again and again and again and again. The bull didn't know what to do, so the guy grabbed the bull by the tail, and the bull was now at a disadvantage. He couldn't catch the man, and he couldn't shake him from his tail. The more they ran, the madder the bull got. He pawed up the earth and bellowed until you could hear him miles away. Finally, he broke into a dead run, the man still hanging onto his tail. The neighbor, now dragging along behind, shouted at the bull, "Darn you! Darn you! You commented thus! Why do you not stop? Why do you not stop?" That's our situation here, Lincoln summarized. It's our duty to settle this fuss at the earliest possible moment, no matter who commenced it, who started it. In Lincoln's day, he was well known as a humorist and a storyteller. The following anecdote about two Quaker women discussing Lincoln and Confederate President Jefferson Davis at the beginning of the Civil War illustrates this. The first Quaker lady said, after some contemplation, that she believed the Confederacy would win the war because Jefferson Davis is a praying man. But Abraham Lincoln is a praying man too, the second Quaker lady protested. Yes, yes, the first admitted, but the Lord will think Abraham is joking. Doing right is a tricky proposition. There are no straight roads that run through democracy. The process twists and turns up and down. It's like the paths, animal paths across the prairie. You never see a straight one. They curve, they twist, they go around, they go through. And the birds, they just don't go in one straight line. They arc and dive and let the drafts carry them. The streams meander, rivers wiggle and ripple their way across the land. In civilization, few things actually ever move in a straight line. The same is for our lives. How often have your beliefs changed in your lifetime? Do you remember when you were 10 what you believed, and 20 and 25 and 30, 35, if you're older than 35? You can see how wisdom, if it's working, will circle around and close in and ask you to open up to new ideas and new ways. The big social transformations are centuries in the making. They don't happen with one war, with one decade, with one administration, with 100 years. They take hundreds and hundreds of years to really fully find their place. And then something new begins. Lincoln believed that if you want to win a man in your cause, you need to find a way into his heart through what he said, the great high road of reason. But if there are high roads, we know there are valleys and underground passageways. Democracy and our progressive faith works when we engage in seeking truth in all its complexity and don't try to simplify it into this or that. But at some point, you have to let go of that bull's tail. Lincoln, one of our most esteemed presidents, loved for freeing the slaves, said, "As I could not be a slave, so I could not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy everywhere. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy." But what that meant to Abraham Lincoln changed a lot over his lifetime. In childhood, he was raised in the separate Baptist church, which mostly did not believe in slavery. His father was a farmer in Kentucky, but there were no land grants. People just took land, and then as the slave movement took over the economy of Kentucky, the large landowners forced the little landowners like Abraham Lincoln's father out. So he found a great injustice in that. Lincoln first opposed slavery in 1854 when he also declared that putting down the slaveholders would not change anybody's mind. Even though Lincoln argued that the founding fathers' phrase, "all men are created equal," applied to blacks and whites alike, this did not mean he believed they should have the same social and political rights. In the 1858 series of debates, well known with Stephen Douglas, he was accused of supporting Negro equality. Lincoln made his position clear. "I will say that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races." He opposed blacks having the right to vote, to serve on juries, to hold office, and to intermarry with whites. He believed, like all men, blacks had the right to improve their condition in society and to enjoy the fruits of their labor. And for this reason, he believed slavery unjust. And one of the great things he believed that could solve the problem of slavery in America was if most of the African Americans, if not all, would just get up and move to Central America or back to Africa. He had a delegation of freed men who had been slaves and abolitionists meet him as he was writing the Emancipation Proclamation, and he argued with all his heart for them to just acknowledge that it would be better off if we were separated. If, in fact, you moved to Liberia, the abolitionists and the freedmen were incensed. So out of that version of the Emancipation Proclamation, this whole notion of wanting them to be away and separate began to dissolve. And many people think that the Emancipation Proclamation was something that freed the slaves. It wasn't meant to do that. That's not its purpose. Its purpose was to keep the Union from being severed permanently. That's why he wrote it. It was not to free the slaves. In fact, most slaves were not freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. But as it turned out, because Lincoln was such a superb politician, he understood that with this declaration that there should be no such thing as slavery, that he could gain a lot of ground in Europe and with the Union movement. And after finally delivering the proclamation after the bloody battle of Antietam, which gave Lincoln the opportunity he needed to really make a bold move, he spoke the Emancipation Proclamation. And he said, "I can only trust in God. I have made no mistake. It is now for the country and the world to pass judgment on it." One of the people that heard it way after it had been given was Booker T. Washington, the founder of Tuskegee University, a political advisor and writer. And as a boy of 9 years old in Virginia, he remembered, as the great day drew nearer, there was more singing in the slave quarters than usual. It was bolder, had more ring, and lasted later into the night. Most of the verses of the plantation songs had some reference to freedom. Some man who seemed to be a stranger, a United States officer, I presume, made a little speech and then read a very long paper, the Emancipation Proclamation. After the reading, we were told that we were all free and we could go when and where we pleased. My mother, standing by my side, leaned over and kissed her children while tears of joy ran down her cheeks. She explained to us all what it all meant, that this was the day for which she had been so long praying, but fearing that she would never live to see. Lincoln's proclamation made a marked a crucial turning point in the evolution of Lincoln's views on slavery. By the war's end, some 200,000 black men would serve in the Union Army and Navy, striking a mortal blow against the institution of slavery and paving the way for the eventual abolition by the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution outlaws slavery and involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime. It was passed by the Senate on April 8, 1864, and adopted on December 6, 1865. So today we celebrate that enormous passage. Today we think of Lincoln as a great leader. Probably many of you feel he's one of our greatest presidents, and he has been and is. We recall his eloquent speeches, his dedication to the Union, and his superior leadership. We don't remember that this understanding of equality between African Americans and people of European descent was not always noble. Yet his beliefs evolved. The process of democracy, with all its twists and turns, led Lincoln to the high road of reason, where what was once abstract had become real, as 750,000 people, 2.5% of the American population, died in this war. He saw the real face of war and what it did to a nation. And he had to directly deal with its ugly truths. So I believed at some point his heart was touched with a reality that his mind could not comprehend, and therefore became, in his last speech in 1865, before he was shot, he said that every single man who fought in the Civil War, who was a freedman, should have the right to vote. So he moved from feeling that there should be no right to vote to the people who had served in the Civil War as freedmen should have the right. So let us fast forward a little bit, quite a bit. During the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s, Lyndon B. Johnson invoked the Emancipation Proclamation, holding it up as a promise yet to be fully implemented. And anybody who watched this election this last fall and summer and spring and winter, we know that at the heart of this race, racism reared its ugly head. Let's make no mistake about that. As President Johnson again invoked the proclamation in a speech presenting the Voting Rights Act, a joint session of Congress on Monday, March 15, 1965, 100 years later. This was 1 week after violence had been inflicted on peaceful civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama. Johnson said, "It's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome. As a man whose roots go deeply into Southern soil, I know the agonizing racial feelings, what they are." I know how difficult it is to reshape the attitudes and the structure of our society. And we know that there's still lots of racial injustice in this country, not only with African people of African American descent, Native Americans, but one area that the Unitarian Universalist Association has devoted a great deal of energy and resources and love to is the immigration issue. Last Sunday, I was fortunate to attend with our Social Action Committee, I believe, the first interfaith meeting in Manhattan to begin to see if we couldn't come together to help those people who are immigrants, most of them being Latino, but there are a lot of Asian immigrants who also need help. But I'm going to focus on the Latino population. There was a wonderful woman who works with the Advocacy for Pregnant Women, and she emailed me some statistics last week. She said in 2010, there were 1,118 live births. And if you were to rate them on a scale of overly adequate or plus adequate, adequate, intermediate, inadequate, in terms of prenatal care, in terms of their ability to have a doctor or a midwife or a nurse practitioner work with them, out of those 1,118, there were 262 that had adequate plus. 602 were adequate. 90 were intermediate, which means that they first saw a doctor at 6 months. And inadequate, there were 152. And this means 7 months or no prenatal care at all. In 2010, this represented about 50 Latina women who had no prenatal care or very little in Riley County. In the last 12 months, over 100 Latina women have had no prenatal care. None. Zip. Zero. And we know that facilitating healthy pregnancies and positive health outcomes pays dividends far beyond anything that we can calculate to our society. So let's just take a quick scan of the services that are available in Manhattan. You can go to the Women's Health Group in Manhattan, and it'll cost somewhere between $2,900 and $3,600. Many of these people are living in a mobile home with multiple families. Do you think that they have, at say, for instance, if you go to the Flint Hills OBGYN in Junction City, the first visit, you have to plunk down $1,300. Otherwise, you will get no care. In Clay Center, each visit is a minimum of $100. And the total care will probably be somewhere between $3,600 and $4,000. The Riley County Health Department, no prenatal care for immigrants. The Catholic Charities of Manhattan do some help with educating women who are pregnant on what to expect and try to guide them as best they can. Social workers from Family Connections advise their clients to go to the emergency department of Mercy Health Center for OB care because the hospital cannot refuse services to pregnant women. SOBRA is a federally funded program that will pay for emergency services such as delivery and life-threatening situations to undocumented or documented immigrants with no insurance. Yet international students who become pregnant with no insurance are not eligible. Total hospital cost for a two-day delivery will be between $8,500 and $10,000. Who can help? The uninsured pregnant woman of Manhattan. Lincoln said, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy everywhere. Whatever differs from this to the extent of the difference, there is no democracy. So when there are young women, adult women, women moving into middle age who become pregnant, and they have no services available to them, I would say that is not democracy. That is not democracy. Another issue that the UUA and the program Standing on the Side of Love devotes its resources and energy and love to is in the realm of gay rights. Right now, there is incredible need to pay attention to what's happening in Uganda. The Ugandan parliament is poised to once again consider a bill known as Kill the Gays Bill, or the Anti-Homosexuality Act. The process, they propose jail terms for all LGBTQ individuals, including a life sentence or even the death penalty in some circumstances. The bill is likely to pass Parliament if it comes up for a vote, leaving President Yoweri Museveni's veto as the only remaining hope that the hate-filled bill will not become law. A journalist in Uganda writes, "About 10 years ago, when I first came out to my guardian and later to my closest colleagues at the Daily Monitor newspaper in Uganda, I was nothing short of terrified of losing both family and friends. As I had anticipated, declaring my love to fellow women got me my own share of hopelessness, verbal abuse, and alienation, even from people I trusted the most. Abandoned as a teenager and forced into maturity at a tender age, I always believed in the transformative power of truth. I always believed and the transformative power of truth. As they say, it sets us free. My coming out story as a Pentecostal raised Ugandan lesbian woman mirrors the stories of dozens of other LGBTQ activists in Uganda. Having an LGBTQ identity is already illegal. In addition to the death penalty, the anti-homosexuality bill requires parents to report their own children. So if you are a mother or father, it is your legal duty to report to the forces that be that your child is gay or lesbian or bi or is very confused about their identity. The LGBT community in Uganda has been organizing even so with all these incredible odds against them. And earlier this year, activists held Uganda's first Pride Parade, the very first. "May we continue," she says, "on this path toward justice and equality for LGBT Ugandans. Please sign a petition today that's available on the website. If you go to uua.org and type in Uganda, you'll get the site that will allow you to say no." We, as Unitarian Universalists, stand on the side of love and its truth. And we say no to this monstrosity. On one note of good news, or two notes, I guess, the Supreme Court on Friday announced that it will be hearing two cases which will have a major impact on LGBTQ people. It will decide whether gay marriage is legal in this country. And the other is about the federal government's ability to either afford or deny benefits to gay spouses, which to me is very important, because if I could get Chuck's insurance, Oh my gosh. It's 100 times better than mine and would cost 1/4 of what I am paying. 1/4. So these are very important issues, and we're at a time when the pendulum is swinging in favor of these kinds of rights. More people today are in favor of it than against it. So we need to lift up our voices so it is heard not only across this land, but to other nations where it's very much needed. Sue Null from the UU Church of Brevard, North Carolina. North Carolina just having passed a law which is not in favor of gay rights, carried a sign in the last gay pride parade. "My gay children deserve equal rights." She says of her actions, "I wanted to carry it last year and was cautioned by everyone not to, because I might arouse dissension. I might arouse dissension." So as we believe that we're all in favor and support justice in its many faces and its many ways that it's lived, where in our lives does bigotry remain? Where has the high road of reason not reached our hearts? I talked to a dear friend of mine who is the president of the Pacific School of Religion, the largest place for people to get doctorates in religion in the country, and served as provost and president of the Fielding Institute, an organization which affords master's and doctor's degrees in social transformation in Santa Barbara. She is a UCC minister. And I asked her about, well, what do you think about gay issues in churches? She said, "You peel the face back of any church, any fellowship, and you will find homophobia. It's here. It's in me. It's in all of us." And not to face it, not to look at it, is to keep the oppression moving in the wrong direction. So if you are uncomfortable with a gay man who is like this, because it's too feminine, it's too wild, he's being too outrageous, are you being bigoted? I don't know. But I know that there are ways that LGBTQ people can make almost everybody uncomfortable, especially if they act up. If they let it be known that they're gay. As long as you just kind of hang out and be nice and be like the rest of us, it'll be okay. We will accept you. We will sign your petitions. We will even take welcoming congregation classes and become a welcoming congregation fellowship. But there's more work to do, as there is with women's rights, with immigrants' rights, with seniors' rights. There's bigotry everywhere, and it's our job as Unitarian Universalists not to back away from the uncomfortable truths that we all carry. Not to dwell on them or to make them into something that you beat someone up with, but to say, hey, here's a place where I can do a little work. And I can open my heart. I can use the high road of reason. And I can come to a better place. If you continue to seek the truth, not the truth you once told yourself or has been told to you, and allow yourself to move into the darkness of not knowing, the high road of reason may reveal itself. And it is from this place that your heart can be reached and you can reach others. So that was a lot, right? Encompassed a lot of stuff. But in what areas of your life have you noticed a kind of bigotry or a kind of reaction to something that you think, oh, you're a little bit surprised that you had this feeling? And how have you worked to fix that or to change it, to become more open, to allow yourself to be transformed, to be free? So I invite you now to share whatever you might feel like sharing. Katie?
I'm Katie Kingery Page. I know many of you here. I just wanted to share that the crisis really around women's health care in Raleigh County, if you perceive it from another face, it actually extends much higher into economic strata as well. And this came to my attention when I was just about a month pregnant with my last child. What I learned was that our practice here, our women's healthcare practice, openly raises funds for an anti-choice group within their practice. And I found this out when I went there and in the lobby was asked to donate money to something called Life Choice Ministries. That hit me in the face. What you're talking about, that hit me in the face. Because as a woman who believes in reproductive freedom, I suddenly felt a huge conflict. And I decided I couldn't have my child here with that practice, even though I'd had one previously with the same practice and just wasn't aware. And so how that moved me and changed me is I decided that that was the year I was coming out of the closet as a supporter of women's reproductive rights. Because, you know, often I think folks who feel that way, we want to be pleasant and like everyone else. And in this community, that means being silent. And so through Betty Banner and a few other wonderful people, I was connected to the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Foundation, and I started to be a part of the group that hangs out at the Kansas State Fair in a booth that says pro-choice above it. And what happened was instead of being scary or confirming all my worst fears that when I was open about those beliefs that I'd be the subject of criticism or hatred or anger or any of those things, in fact, it was so affirming. Excuse me, thousands of people who you might not expect to support women's reproductive freedom would stop at our booth, donate money, voice, and express their support.
Thanks, Katie. Another voice that would like to be lifted up?
Anna Franklin. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about, you know, bigotry and how we can even have it towards ourselves. We can choose, you know, what we are outspoken about and what we keep quiet about and what we do to sort of fit in and blend in. And it is important to a lot of people to fit in and not make waves. And I was just talking to a young woman the other day who happened to bring up energy healing. And even energy healing, you know, was something that she felt as though, you know, people look at you weird if you talk about energy healing. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's nowhere near, you know, prejudiced against immigrants or gay people or anything like that. But even something like just, I think, you know, the rose quartz earrings that I'm wearing have a certain energy, and that's through my own experience, it's what I've found empirically, but I can't talk about it because people think I'm a nut. They already know I'm a nut, but that's okay.
Thank you, Anna. Marissa?
I guess when I decided to become a mother, a single mother by choice, a prejudice of mine came out in that from my high school and college days, I had several friends who were very religious. I would, you know, call them Bible thumpers. And I just assumed, I was scared to tell them about my choice and, you know, after I was well into my pregnancy. And just assuming that they would be judgmental and look down on me because I'd heard of other women who had single mothers by choice who had problems with their families and their religious friends judging them. And thankfully, all of my very religious friends were truly my friends and were very supportive. And that actually, it made me feel a little guilty that I had put that on them, that I had prejudged them, that they were going to.
Charlie?
Hi, I'm Charlie Kempthorne. I only have one hearing aid this morning, Michael, so maybe I only heard half of what you said. But I thought you said that bigotry is in us. That was what I heard best in your whole talk, and I appreciate that. And I'm quick history here. In 1967, I was a alternate delegate to the National Convention for New Politics, which, of course, was to the left of everything else in those days. And we went down to Chicago, and among other things, there were a lot of blacks there, Floyd McKissick and all the gang from the 60s. King didn't come, but everybody else was there. And it was a great experience. And I was the good liberal, and I had a few hundred extra books, and in between the talks, I talked with a black man from Mississippi, and I was ready to donate these books in my great kindness. And he was kind of snippy with me. Well, yeah, there are ways to do that. Just see so-and-so or whatever. And then later on, he and some of the people, the group he represented, stood up and told us liberals and even radical whites that what we needed to do was to, if we really wanted to help blacks and racism in America, we could go back to our hometowns and start white civilizing committees. And I was kind of offended. White civilizing committees? You know, but it took me about 10 years to understand he was right. Mm. And if perhaps a little cheeky about it, you know, but it is in us. And I figure the best thing I can do, really, is not to call out someone else for racism, but try to expunge it in myself or delay it or sideline it or something. Anyway.
I know that I'm new and that I probably shouldn't be speaking out so quickly, but here I go. I was really happy to hear all of the talk about the kinds of discrimination groups that are discriminated against in the world, but I wanted to give you one more because I think it seems appropriate to today, to the wonderful talk we had today, and that is sexual oppression and sexual slavery, especially for young girls and especially for girls of minority groups, and especially girls who don't speak English and are transported and sold by their families. And one of the problems with this particular group is that there are laws that prevent this sort of thing, but no one believes those laws. And so the kinds of laws that we have, if people believe that they're really going to be enforced, it does help, and it goes along on the continuum that was talked about today. And the continuum is important because most of these girls have absolutely no protection. I was listening to one of those programs on public television last night where they talked about a Buddhist sect that had imprisoned girls to become perpetual birth givers. And they were very young, you know, 11, 12-year-old girls. And they were kept in the monastery there, and they were impregnated constantly. Very little food, very little care, very little everything. And I know this is an extreme example, but we have these kinds of groups in this country, and they are used for prostitution, and they are used for pleasures, and they are really beaten, and they are really treated very badly. And I think sometimes we forget that in our own communities we have things that are going on, and I would like to have, you know, someone think about maybe focusing on a group of children who are really seriously abused. It isn't just girls, but it's mostly girls. Girls and boys are both afflicted by this particular issue. And sometimes when I hear civil rights talks, I don't hear much mention of this particular group. And I really think this is a very unfortunate omission. And I hope that we begin to think about this one as well as all the other issues that are so unfair and so unreasonable. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beeman. And growing up as a psychiatrist's daughter, you might have thought I'd be more open-minded about mental illness, but it seemed like it never touched my family personally. But when I got older, I realized there was plenty of craziness in the family I grew up in. And now, since I've been in my adult years for a really long time, we've experienced lots of depression, bipolar personalities, and Alzheimer's in my family. And I have a different attitude about it. I saw plenty of old people where my mother, who had Alzheimer's, lived, whose families never visited them. It was too horrible. I had an aunt who gave a relative who had Alzheimer's. She's still absolutely delightful and loving, and my aunt and uncle would never go see her. They couldn't stand to see it. And there's been numerous cases of continuing depression in my family. It's really, really hard for us to deal with, really hard on my husband and me and the person who's suffering. And that's really something that nobody talks about and is, I think, a really taboo subject, mental illness. And so there you go.
This will have to be our last one. Yes, the pressure is on. Include everything that was omitted, please.
Gosh. I'm Mike Bonella. One of the things that I was sitting here thinking about, you know, asked to think of my own bigotry and what I've done to change. And you know, you hear people often refer to things as, oh, that's so retarded. I have said that word in that context. And as someone who is involved with a program that tries to teach job skills to developmentally disabled, I've become very sensitive to that word. And we, I was telling Laura this weekend, I forget where we were, but there was a person working who used that word to us. And I decided after that, I said, I think I'm going to start telling people that say that, you know, hey, I have someone in my life who is developmentally disabled. I don't like that word. And I really don't have somebody in my family that is like that, but it just, I think it'd make people think like, oh crap, you know, I can't believe I just did that. We were at a restaurant and the waiter was apologizing that he wasn't very good at remembering things because he rode the short bus to work this morning. And I thought, you're an idiot. So it's something that I've come to realize, and it's something we didn't address in this talk today that I wanted to mention, and it is a word that's very hurtful to some. Just like, you know, another one that's used in a similar way is, oh, that's so gay. You hear young people say that, and I'd put that in the same class as saying, oh, that's retarded. They just don't think of it, you know, or I Jewed them down. You know, instead of saying haggle, I always speak up to that one. I'll just say, well, do you know what religion I am? And you see him pause like, oh, crap. And then, you know, I try to correct people now when I hear those kinds of things and make them think. And I think that brings about change.
Good. Thank you, everyone who shared. And let's continue the conversation after we sing our closing hymn, which is in the teal hymnal. 1002, Comfort Me.
I try to scatter the teal hymnals through the room, and if you don't see one close by, find somebody to have one, and we will read this song, which is, you catch on to the
That's where it came. That's where it came. That's where it came. Oh, my soul. Comfort me. Comfort me. Comfort me, comfort me, oh my soul.
Why should there not be patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in the world? Let us have faith that right makes right, and in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. Abraham Lincoln, let's go rejoice with one another.